This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
I would like to welcome to the Sub 70 podcast Jason Way. He's the founder of GeekDonGolf.com and an architect aficionado. So welcome to the podcast, and thank you for the time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So my first question is, how did you come up with the concept of GeekDon Golf, and what was the initial goals of launching the website and the brand?
Oh, boy. As is the case with many things that I get myself into, I just decided one night and then told my wife about it, my long-suffering wife about it, that I thought that I was just going to start writing about my journey back into the game. And what I mean by that is I grew up playing golf competitively as a kid and caddying, and was just completely immersed in the game. And I went away to college at the University of Illinois, and I tried to walk on there and was unsuccessful. And then for the next 20 years, basically hung my clubs up. And I don't think I played more than 10 times over the course of that 20 years. I just completely lost touch with the game. And in my late 30s, about 7 years ago, I decided to take the game back up. And my original intention was to try and get good again and maybe see if I could compete at a mid-am level. And so I was working on my game and signed up for a tournament, a mid-am qualifier, and really just hated it. I thought that there might be a competitive itch still there, and there wasn't. But I loved golf, and so I started the blog really kind of as a way of documenting the process of like getting back into the game and kind of learning how to play again with, you know, modern equipment and on modern courses, and just kind of getting back in touch with my passion for it. And as I started to write and play more and, you know, network and adventure and read and do the things that golf geeks do, what I found was most compelling to me about the game was the courses. That, you know, in my mind, what really separates golf from other sports is the, just the art and variety associated with our playing fields. You know, I grew up caddying at the Old Elm Club up in Highland Park, Illinois, which is a Harry Colt, Donald Ross course. And I also grew up playing at the Fort Sheridan Army Base course because my grandfather was a vet. And so, you know, an interesting contrast between, you know, this highly exclusive, you know, private club with as good an architectural pedigree as you're ever going to see, and this essentially was a community golf course, which was in very kind of hard scrabble condition most of the time on the Army Base. But, you know, each of them, you know, stimulating my passion in its own way. And so the blog very quickly turned from me kind of charting my course back into the competitive side of the sport to, you know, exploring my love of golf courses. And then I found myself going down the whole rabbit hole of architecture. And that, you know, at the bottom of that rabbit hole is this crazy subculture of, you know, architecture and golf course geeks who, you know, I found to be very much kindred spirits with me about how we look at the game and how we look at golf courses and how we look at the experience of playing. And the writing just kind of, and the networking just kind of went from there. So when I originally started geekedongolf.com, I really thought it was just going to be a kind of a personal diary. And I thought maybe, you know, my wife and my mom, maybe two friends would read it. But once I got tapped into that, you know, architecture subculture, There are a lot of people who are out there, talking about and discussing and writing about that subject and taking photos and sharing photos. And we found each other, and the rest is history, so to speak. It's become much more of a thing than I ever intended it to be. And a heck of a lot of fun, in part because I like expressing myself and I like the process of exploring and sharing what I find. And in part just because it has been such a great platform for meeting kindred spirits. That's been the biggest thing for me, is I've really found my people and have made some fantastic friends and, have golf buddies all over the country and all over the world because of it. So I'm super grateful for the experience so far.
I'll tell you what, Old Elm is as good as it gets. I absolutely love that golf course. On a side note here, is that good architecture. As a follow-up, as the website and the concept sort of changed, what feedback did you get from the visitors to the website? And then where do you think the concept can kind of go in the future as sort of like a part two to getting the website started?
I'm a visual guy. I like to write, obviously. But in terms of, digital content, at least, I'm not a big reader of long form content online. I just don't like looking at my phone screen or computer screen long enough to really read in-depth content in print online. But pictures, give me pictures. I will look at pictures, especially of golf courses and golf holes and features of golf holes, for hours and hours and hours. I started tinkering with just taking some of my own photos, and they're mediocre. Every once in a while I'll get a good one, and I got some advice on how to do that, and I just started sharing those things. And then I got connected with, Evan Schiller, who is a photographer, and he did an interview for me and shared some of his photos, which are fantastic. And then I got connected with, John Cavalier right when he was getting started with sharing some of his photos on social media. And then he started, sharing some of his photo tours and some of his photos on my site as well. And he's become a kind of a key collaborator with me amongst a handful of other guys. And, you can tell just by looking at his social media feeds that obviously I'm not the only one in the world who likes to look at golf course pictures all day. So even though, I think of myself as a decent writer, and what people tell me is what they like about the way that I write is that it's personal. It's not formal. I think what really has caused my site to take off and resonate with people is it's just visually rich, and I try and keep it that way. In terms of where it goes from here, I don't really know. I didn't have a plan, honestly, setting out at the beginning, and I'm not sure that I have any kind of a long-term plan at this point. There are more kind of departments within my site, and guys who I like to collaborate with. I've started to collaborate a little bit with Andy Johnson from The Fried Egg. Been collaborating a little bit with Simon Haynes, who is has this massive and very cool collection of historical golf photos. And of course, John Cavalier and some of the guys from Sugarloaf Social Club. And there's a group of us who, we come together around ideas that, we share an interest in. And we really just decide as we go along, we're going to write this up, or we're going to shoot this video or take these photos and put together this content, and where's it going to go? And to a certain degree, that whole process is kind of organic and free form. And because this is a hobby for me, this isn't a job for me. I have a full-time job and I do this just for fun on the side. I like the fact that it's organic and it's just kind of, it's developing, according to inspiration and where it wants to, as opposed to me saying, two years from now, this is what I want it to be. Because I started off with one intention for the site, and it has gone in a number of other directions, and I'm better for that. So I'm just kind of letting it go.
Let's talk about some golf course architecture and design. And my first question from that standpoint is, what, in your opinion, makes a really good golf course? And on the flip side, what can make a golf course really bad?
So, you know, as is the case with kind of the masthead of my my site, it says it's a celebration of what's great. I tend to focus on the things that I like more than the things that I don't like. Part of that, just that's my nature, and the other part of that is having, you know, tinkered around with Canal Shores and you know, pitched in on that project and learned a lot from architects about, you know, the nuts and bolts of how they get their work done, and learned a lot from superintendents about the nuts and bolts of how they get their work done. I'm cautious and not quick to criticize, because, you know, I obviously have preferences. But, you know, the people who work in those professions really, really work hard, and what they do is very hard. I mean, you know, trying to collaborate with nature is fundamentally not easy. So, you know, to answer your first question of what do I think makes for good architecture, is that it engages your head. If I can stand on the tee and there's only one way to play a hole, I get bored. Because then it becomes a test of the body. Like, can you execute or not this one thing? And if you do, you're rewarded. And if you don't, you're punished. As soon as the, you know, that one thing is executed properly, I just kind of get bored. My mind wanders. And I think that the best architecture presents choices and presents trade-offs, where the land is used and hazards are placed in such a way that, you know, each hole is a puzzle and the course as a whole is a puzzle. And, you know, unlocking that puzzle takes using your head and using your body, and doesn't necessarily, the answers don't necessarily present themselves easily right at first. I hope that makes sense.
And I mean, there's this renaissance in golden age architecture now, which personally I think is the best. It's, you know, Seth Rayner and Harry Colt, and it's my favorite way to play golf. And from a history of architecture, when did, and this is where I'm kind of using a generic era of when it started going bad. I don't prefer the 1980s, for lack of a better word, tree line, difficult golf course, one way to play it, long is better, which, you know, long can be fine at some time, but when every hole is kind of the same. Why was it so great, unless you don't agree with me, in the golden age of architecture? And then how do you think the concept sort of got to where it got bad in the 80s and 90s? In my opinion, I think it got, generically speaking, not nearly as good as it did in, from that period.
Well, I think that, you know, what resonates with people like me and about the golden age is twofold. I think that those architects, they did, you know, quite a bit of collaborating amongst themselves, and, you know, they were building out the strategic principles, bringing them over from the greatest courses in the British Isles and trying to implement those strategic principles of, you know, choice, you know, risk reward choice, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it. And the use of angles to gain advantage, and these kind of fundamental principles they were baking into their golf courses. However, you know, on top of that was a pretty rich and varied aesthetic. So, you know, if you look at, you know, C.B. McDonald and Seth Rayner versus what Donald Ross did versus what Colt and Allison did versus what McKenzie did, they all have distinct style. So, you know, baked into the courses was variety from a strategic perspective and sound strategic principles. And then layered on top of that were these just varied and brilliant aesthetics that, you know, make exploration of golden age golf courses just endlessly interesting. I mean, even if you just take, you know, the work of Donald Ross, or you take the work of Seth Rayner, they have a style, but they kept pushing it. You can tell that there's, if you go to their courses in different parts of the country, or you go to courses that they built during different, you know, kind of segments in their careers, there's a lot of variety there. I think what got lost post-World War II up until, you know, basically Sandhills opened and the renaissance of, you know, the second golden age, if that's what you want to call it, started, was difficulty became king and a uniform look became king. And, I think the taste changed during that time. And certainly, you know, television, you know, the impact on aesthetics that television had, especially the impact of people seeing Augusta National and that very refined aesthetic that they were showing on TV, that very green aesthetic that they were showing on TV. And then, you know, the influence of the PGA Tour. And there's just a lot of uniformity in the golf courses that, you know, up until recently were being played on the PGA Tour. And that's what people saw. And so they went back to their home club and they said, you know, I want it to look like this. And, you know, architects are artists, but they are also business people. And at a certain level, a business person has to just, you know, respond to the demand. And so I just think there was a lot of homogenization of the golf courses that were being built, and they were building a lot of them at that time. And so, you know, necessarily the quality is going to go down. The attention to detail is going to go down. I mean, if you're building 10 or 15 golf courses a year, this is not going to be the same as if you build one or two. So I think that a lot of those factors conspired to, you know, create a subset of golf courses, an era of golf course architecture that I just don't personally find terribly compelling, because, you know, I want to be challenged for sure. I want my head engaged. I want to be asked to execute certain things. But I don't want to be, I don't go out on a golf course to be punished. For me, it's not an ego trip. I have enough challenge in my daily life of being a businessman and being a father and being a member of my community that, you know, the primary reason that I play golf is for recreation, is for fun. Now, like I said before, if there's no challenge, then it gets boring, just as if there's too much challenge, it gets boring for me. So it's finding that sweet spot is a real, you know, a real art form. And finding that sweet spot in terms of the courses that I play on a regular basis, it takes some hunting around. But that's part of what I find fun about it. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but I think that, you know, we've emerged from that period where, you know, penal, difficult architecture that was, you know, uniformly presented as green wall to wall has now given way to a lot more creativity, a lot more strategy, and a lot more honoring of the principles that made those golden age courses so great and so enduring in the first place.
So kind of looking back, and I'm going to combine two of my questions here because you brought up Sandhills. Do you think what Dick Youngscap and Core Crenshaw did there essentially highlighted the golden age and how great it could be? And do you think the renaissance in that love of that style of golf was started for what they did, which in 1995 was completely the opposite of the way everybody else was building golf courses? Do you think that was sort of the catapult to kind of get this idea going again?
Yeah, I think that was the kind of the re-spark. And, you know, something has to be said for the exposure that the internet has given as well. Because if I'm a golf consumer and all I see are either the courses that are being shown on TV each week or, you know, what's in my own backyard coming out of the era of the, you know, 40s through the 80s, basically, unless I'm, you know, a wealthy person and I have access to a place like Old Elm. And I'm not seeing very much that's going to, you know, stimulate me or stir my soul. And that's all I know. Were it not for, you know, the advent of the internet at the same time that Corin Crenshaw were doing that work, and at the same time that Pete Dye was doing the work that he was doing, which was really kind of smashing down barriers, and at the same time that Tom Doak was doing his writing and starting to do his work, you know, the internet, I think, really accelerated the exposure to those ideas and to that work in a way that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. Because what's the likelihood that the average Joe is ever going to know anything about Sand Hills if it's not for the internet?
Yeah, I agree.
But those things become legendary, and they become, you know, they, you know, the internet, whether it's Golf Club Atlas or, you know, now what you see happening on Twitter and on Instagram, where, you know, it allows people to ask the question, well, what makes this great? You know, I can kind of, I can see it. I can see that it's different, but why is it great? And then, you know, you attract a lot of people like me who love to sit around and debate the answer to that question. And that opens up people's minds to what they see every day. And, you know, maybe I ought to get in the car and drive and check something out that I might not normally see. And that's, I think that we're really just reaching the peak of that now, you know, 20 plus years later, that, you know, the idea that you got to get off the beaten track and the idea that you ought to look at things a little bit differently is really, I still just think that we're scratching the surface of the average golfer's consciousness.
When I played Sand Hills in 06, it changed what I thought I still think it's the best golf course I've ever played, but we made the trek out there, and I was even more blown away from actually seeing it. And it's, I tell people, you know, if you can get, it's my favorite area of the of the world so far I've visited to play golf is Dismal River Club, Sand Hills, Ballyneal, that Sand Hill sort of region. It changed my idea from thinking a Parkland style tough 18 hole track that you can find around Chicagoland is the, you know, epitome of golf. And it kind of gave me, but I agree, gave me the appreciation for Golden Age as a 2.0 of going out there and seeing that. But you're right. You have to kind of make the trek, and people are like, you're going to drive 11 hours in the middle of Nebraska to go play golf. And I'm like, well, if you can get on there and if you see these tracks, it does something to your soul that you don't get from playing Medina. I'm sorry. It doesn't happen
that way. Yeah. I mean, that's the same reason why, you know, a couple of my buddies and I badger everyone both online and off that we possibly can to go see a place like Lawsonia.
Fantastic.
Because
I love Lawsonia.
You know, yeah, you come around the corner on the first hole at Lawsonia and you see that green. And, you know, if you've never seen anything like that before, if you've never seen a McRainer course before, which is hard, you know, most people don't get a chance to play at a McRainer course because almost all of them are private, and very private. So when you know, the average Joe who watches the PGA Tour and plays at his local, you know, public course or at his, you know, country club every day, who goes and sees that, it's just their eyes pop out of their head. And it is a life-changing experience to see a place like Lawsonia or Sand Hills or, you know, Ballyneal or some of the other things that, you know, or to go to Bandon or Stream Song now, or even to see the redo of Pinehurst number 2. I mean, these are things that's like, wow, I didn't even realize that a golf course could look like that. I didn't even realize that you could build something like that. And not only would it be massively visually impactful, but it's also strategically interesting and functional. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. And that's why, you know, I really try and make those recommendations to my friends and anybody else who will listen as much as I can, because they come back and they say, you know, you weren't kidding. Like, I still can't wrap my head around some of the things that I saw, and it changes everything.
Have you had a chance to play Dismal River yet when you were out there?
I have not. The only trip that I made out to that area was just to play Ballyneal and Sand Hills. It was a couple of days, and I didn't have the time to run around and see everything in that area. Dismal's on my list. So is Wild Horse.
Awesome. It's fantastic.
There's more exploration to do in that area of the country, but that's, you know, every time I have a conversation like this, things get added to the list.
Yeah, and at Dismal, I played that for, oh gosh, the last 12 years, basically. And it was, when I first played out there on the Nicklaus design before the Dote course was built, I thought it was the hardest golf course I've ever played in my life. I mean, I don't even think they had a slope rating because the wind could, you know, when they had one, it was like 78 and change. Mm-hmm. And they mellowed it out. And they moved the tees up a little bit, and they widened some areas, and they didn't water and stuff. And right now, it kind of got a bad rap when it first opened. But if you go out there now, how that's not a top 50 golf course in the United States, and the Dote course has been fantastic from day one, but they've really got the Nicklaus course fun, better. It's such a beautiful piece of property. They finally got it right. So if you get out there, and that bad rap, how it kind of first came out, they've totally fixed it. It's just absolutely fantastic. It truly is.
Yeah, it doesn't have a bad rap in my mind. I've read, obviously, there are a lot of pictures of the red course out there, and then I read Ran Morissette's review of the white course, and he had nothing but good things to say about it, and I trust his judgment. So it's on my hit list for sure. I just haven't made it happen yet.
Well, let's talk about the project that you're working on for Canal Shores. What's sort of the history behind you being involved in it, and what's the ultimate goal you guys are trying to do with the project?
So the history is like I said, I was working on my game, and Canal Shores is about a half a mile from my house. And so, you know, I actually stumbled upon the course when I first moved to the Northwest Evanston. I had a dog. This was when I wasn't playing golf. I had a dog, and I would take him over there in the wintertime because he had an insane amount of energy, and I would just let him run free. And we'd just walk around the place. And there are a lot of dog walkers out there, and in the wintertime especially, it kind of turns into a dog park. So I'd take him out there, and he'd play. And when I got back to playing, I really didn't, you know, I wasn't a member of a club in the area. And the handful of public courses that we have in the area are very crowded. So I would go out there to practice, and the course was in an extreme state of disrepair. The greens were basically unputtable. They were just barely mowing the grass. And since it seemed like nobody really cared about the place, I felt like it was okay for me to go out there and essentially use it as a, you know, a practice area, driving range, short game, chipping, all that kind of stuff. And so I was doing that one fall. Nobody ever said anything to me. I very rarely saw any other golfers out there. And then I came back the following spring as soon as the weather broke, and I was out hitting balls one day on my lunch break, and a guy came up to me in a gator, and he said, "What do you think you're doing?" I said, "I'm hitting golf balls." He said, "This isn't a driving range. If you want to be out here, you got to give me $10. And I said, "Well, I don't have $10 on me." And he's like, "Well, then, okay, then you got to leave." So I'm like, "Well, that was interesting. At least somebody cares." So I went home, got $10. And the next day I went over to the maintenance shed and I found somebody. I'm like, you know, this guy told me that I could come out here and play all I wanted if I paid $10. And the guy who I met said, "Yeah, sure, go crazy." So I gave him my 10 bucks, which probably went right into his pocket. And I went back out and I messed around for a couple of hours. And during the course of that season, cleanup started to happen around the course. Now, unbeknownst to me, they had hired a superintendent and he was starting to clean the course up and work on it. And over the course of that season, it got cleaned up. They started mowing. They started, you know, cutting up and removing fallen trees. And then the greens came back to the point where they were really slow, but they were actually puttable. The superintendent's name was Tom Tully. He's subsequently moved on, but he was a very experienced superintendent, and he did just a miraculous job of, with basically zero resources, making the course playable. And so at the end of that season of being a daily fee player, I just decided that I was going to buy a membership and see if there was any way that I could pitch in and help. Because at that time I really started to get into architecture, and, you know, the property at Canal Shores is just, apart from, you know, the Winter Park Nine and a couple of other places around the country, you just don't see a golf course as embedded in its community as deeply as Canal Shores is. Just the way the place is made, it's really unique. And it's surprising that it never got developed. So through a buddy, I found out that there were these volunteer board meetings, and I showed up and they put me on the grounds committee because I knew something about golf. And I started going to the grounds committee meetings, and there was a small group of us, Tom, the superintendent, plus a couple of other guys, who decided that we were going to start doing some pilot projects to tinker with various aspects of the course, whether it was, you know, expanding the fairways or cutting down trees or fixing up old bunkers. And we were just going to do this stuff and see if anybody noticed. At the same time, we were trying to develop some ideas for, what to do with the course going forward, because it was surviving, but it wasn't thriving. We didn't want to see it go backwards again, as it had so many times in the past. And I started to write about those ideas on Geeked on Golf. And there's a whole series of posts that I've done called Journey Along the Shores, which, you know, it's kind of the unofficial record of our tinkering. And our ideas for, you know, how to reconfigure the course and do some things differently found their way onto Pat Goss's desk. He's the director of golf and player development for Northwestern University. And as it turns out, he had a lot of similar ideas. And he and I were connected by a mutual friend. And it turned out that we're just, you know, cut from the same cloth in terms of golf geekery. So we really hit it off, and, you know, we approached the board about, you know, exploring some of these ideas and seeing if we could get support for them, both, you know, in terms of industry experts and the powers that be, like the USGA and donors. And so we're now a couple of years into that process. We found out that there was obviously a lot of support for our concepts. There's a lot of support for doing things differently in terms of short course golf and, you know, more innovative golf offerings. And since then, we've been, you know, kind of slowly but very surely working our way through, you know, community politics and, you know, the introduction of these ideas. And the board, as it is currently configured, is just, it's all volunteers. It's a nonprofit at Canal Shores. It's not run by a municipality. These are all just people from the community who are pitching in their time and their blood, sweat, and tears, and often money. They're just working their way through, you know, what's the renovation ultimately going to look like, and, you know, how's it going to unfold over the course of the next couple of years. We're not in a situation where we can just, you know, shut the place down and wave a magic wand in 1 year and have it all done. I really don't think it's going to happen that way. I think it's going to happen a little bit more piecemeal, which is, might not be the most efficient way to do it, but it works. I think it's going to work best for, you know, the community that we serve and the youth golfers that we're trying to serve. But exactly what it looks like in the future, I don't know, but I think it's going to be different, and it's going to be community focused, and it's going to be inclusive, and it's going to be that hopefully that right mix of fun and challenge that makes the game interesting to people and makes them want to pick it up and stick with it. You know, in the interim period, I think, you know, we've been a part of this little community golf movement that's happening around the country with places like, you know, Goat Hill and Winter Park and, you know, the whole Save Muni thing. And Rockwind, the Andy Staples project down in New Mexico. And, you know, I'm happy to know that the little dream chasing and tinkering that we've done up until now is, you know, inspired some other people to go and do likewise in their own communities. That makes me very happy to know that people have drawn inspiration from it. But I think that we have a long, slow process ahead of us here. And, you know, that's okay. The gears turn slowly. There was a time in the process where I was really impatient to just, you know, come on, this is a great idea and we should obviously do it. So everybody, let's just get it done. And I've learned that these projects almost never unfold that way. There are a lot of stakeholders involved. There are a lot of different viewpoints that, you know, it's appropriate to hear out and try and incorporate the best way that you can. And when you're doing this all, you know, privately through private donors and through members of the community, it's a very democratic process, and, you know, democratic processes are often messy and, you know, perhaps inefficient, and they just move slowly, but that's okay. It's been really fun and really challenging to be a part of it. And, I have complete faith that we'll see it through to the end.
Has any golf architects kind of helped you on the side with, hey, I would do this, I would do that? Are you getting those guys from that community to kind of put in their two cents as well? Hopefully, you know, not charging a hefty fee or anything like that.
When I first started posting things, it was really kind of a curiosity. And we had a steady stream of architects who, when they came through town, they would come out and see us. I got a lot of advice and support from Drew Rogers early on in the process. Got advice and support from Dave Zinkand, Tim Liddy, and Dave Axland came and visited, and we went for a walk and they offered some feedback. Jim Urbina has been out. Dave Essler has been out. A whole bunch of people. And then, of course, you know, in terms of, you know, online, I've gotten all sorts of support and encouragement and ideas and, you know, offers of assistance. And it's really actually more than I know what to do with. That's been one of the biggest challenges, is just trying to take people up on all of the offers that have been given to us. And it kind of got to a certain point where we were like, okay, like we're so overwhelmed with offers of support and people willing to come out to work, and that we really kind of need to, you know, buckle down and create a master plan. And so that's where we are right now, is that there's been a master plan component on the ecology side that's complete, you know, that deals with the ecology of the property and trying to reestablish native habitat and enhance the property from a ecological perspective. And now we're working on getting our architects formally hired so that they can do a golf component of the master plan and we can get that funded and get the renovation going. But the time for me kind of doing it on a pilot basis and just cobbling together the resources the best I could through my own network, that time has passed. It's getting much more formal now, which is a good thing. But I'm most definitely indebted to people like Drew and people like Dave and Tim and all the people who came out early and, you know, essentially let us know that, like, you're on the right track and this is a great idea, and you're crazy, but you're the right kind of crazy. You know, you're the kind of crazy that the game needs right now, because without having that affirmation, you know, we might have lost steam.
Let's talk Chicago Golf, not Chicago Golf Club, which is obviously great, but the history of Chicago, you know, golf around Chicagoland. What is your three or four favorite golf courses in the Chicagoland area, and what makes those three or four courses so fantastic in your eyes?
Well, you know, I tend to put things into tiers. I've tried to do rankings, and there's like a recency bias, and there's a home field bias that I, like everybody, suffer from. So I find that putting things into tiers is about as objective as I can possibly get. Now I grew up on the North Shore. I actually grew up in Lake Forest. And like I said, I'm, you know, a Old Elm caddy program alum. And so, you know, Old Elm already had a special place in my heart, but you know, the work that Drew Rogers and Dave Zinkin and Curtis James and Kevin Marion have done to, you know, renovate that place and bring the cult out of it has been just absolutely phenomenal in my mind. So I put Old Elm in my top tier. Obviously, you know, Chicago Golf Club is, you know, there's just nothing quite like that place, and just the place that it holds, not just in the history of Chicago golf, but in the history of golf in America, is unique and special. And, you know, going to visit that place is like going to church. That is in my top tier for sure. And then Shore Acres, I just really think that might be one of the most brilliantly routed golf courses I've ever seen, if not the most brilliantly routed. And I'm a McRainer guy. I love their work. And I'm a huge fan of what Brian Palmer does on a day-to-day basis. That guy gets it. And he is just my kind of maniac in terms of never settling for having things be less than as great as they could be. He sweats the details and he does a fantastic job out there. So, you know, those three, Chicago Golf, Shore Acres, and Old Elm, are really kind of in my top tier. And I think that they're a cut above for sure, which is not necessarily to cast any aspersions on any of the courses that come in the tiers after that, because we have a lot of really, really good golf in Chicagoland. I just think that those three are special.
Let's talk about Wisconsin, our neighbors to the north. Starting to get you can do a really good road trip now of taking a tour up there. So in Wisconsin, if you were going to go play three or four, what's sort of on your list on those tracks? And once again, what do you think makes them so special?
Yeah, you know, there's an arms race going on here in the Midwest. You know, there's a lot of competition within Wisconsin, and there's competition, you can tell, between Wisconsin and Michigan. And boy, we are just, other than this god awful weather that we have, it is a good time to be a Midwestern golfer. The renovation and restoration movement has finally reached the Midwest in a very big way. And those of us who have, you know, a network and access benefit from that. And then on the public side, gosh, there's just so much great stuff to see. Like I said, I you know, for me in Wisconsin, Lawsonia is it. I mean, that's 1A. And I try and make a point of going there every year. That place is just so cool. And it might be the most underrated and undervalued golf course in America. I think it's that good. It's a top tenner.
Now we're talking about the links side, not the woodland side.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. The links.
I always tell people, if you have not played Chicago Golf Club, if you don't have the access to do it, there are some holes on that links at Lasonia that have a very similar feel of a few holes at Chicago, if you want to try to get an idea of what it's sort of like. I totally agree with you that it's underrated for how great of a golf course it is. I think it's absolutely fantastic, personally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could make an argument that I'll have to get with my geeks and hash this out, but I might make the argument that Lawsonia is bolder than Chicago Golf Club, which is saying a lot. But yeah, from a style perspective, I mean, Langford and Moreau, those guys were not scared to move earth. So that, you know, Lawsonia is, that's tier one in my mind. I think what they're doing at Sand Valley, the Corin Crenshaw course, is fantastic. I think that I would not be surprised to hear that the average golfer ends up liking Mammoth Dunes more than the Corin Crenshaw course, because the Mammoth Dunes is a really, really, really interesting and unique and fun golf course to play. And then of course the 17 hole sandbox, the par 3 course that they did there, is it's killer. So Sand Valley has gone from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a very short period of time. And the Kaiser's just, they've got a model and it works. It works really well. And anybody who visits that resort is going to have a wonderful time. I make a point of popping over to Kohler once a year just to play a couple of the courses, usually the Straits and the River course. And I enjoy that. It's not something that I would pony up the money. It's really expensive. We get kind of early season rates and we do it that way. I don't know that I could afford to, nor would I choose to pay the money to go there during peak season. But I think that the Straits and River courses are really cool. And so I enjoy those. So those were, you know, those will probably be the top ones. I haven't explored some of the other, public courses in Wisconsin all that much. In part because I love the ones that I go to and I can only get up there so many times because I'm usually headed more towards Michigan during the summer. And also in part because I have access to some of the private places too, you know, like Milwaukee Country Club and Blue Mound, which I think are...
I love Blue Mound. I know they're
doing... Blue Mound is really cool.
Yeah, and they're doing more and more work to kind of bring it back to the Rainer style. But you can... I think they... Are they still planning on taking some trees out of there and trying to open it up even a little
bit
more?
They've been slowly but surely taking trees down and, you know, doing some fairway expansion there. And they've got a diverse membership there, which is great. I think the club, in terms of its health, is strong, as I understand it. But at the same time, you know, it's a lot easier to make changes at a place like Chicago Golf Club, where, you know, most of the members are well-traveled and have a, you know, an appreciation of the history of the place. And, you know, so when you say you're going to do restorative work, they're like, okay, well, that's, they get it. Some of these other clubs, it's a little bit more of a sell. And so I think they're easing their way into it at Blue Mound. But each time I go back, it looks nicer. And honestly, I think that they have some of the coolest Seth Feiner greens you're going to find anywhere.
Yeah, they're really good.
Some really wacky stuff at that place, which is right up my alley.
And another great one is the redo that they did at Century World. You know, it's a different style golf course, but... That turned out great. I mean, if you're ever up to that area as well, it's well worth playing it. They did a fantastic
job. Yeah, that's definitely on my list. I like the work that I see being posted by Jay Blasey. And I've played Chambers Bay, and I know that he was a member of the core crew there. And my guess is that probably had some good influence on what happened there. So... yeah, Century World is definitely on my list.
Well, let's look at Michigan. I know you go up there and play a little bit too. I have not gotten to play this one, but how spectacular is Crystal Downs?
So I think a fair argument could be made that the front nine at Crystal Downs is the best side in America. You know, the front nine is that good. And then there are a couple of holes on the back nine that aren't my favorites on the course, but the heart of the back nine as well, the 12th through the 15th hole, like out at the far end of the property, are just absolutely magnificent as well. And kind of that, the combination of Maxwell's influence on the greens and Mackenzie's bunkering on what is a beautiful piece of property. It's really, really cool. There are times of the year, like in the fall, when the course really firms up and it gets super fast, where it's on the beat you up end of the difficulty scale at times. So I'm not sure that I would want to go out there every day in September and early October and play, because you know, four putting and putting off greens
<Didn't happen.
laughs> gets old. Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's not a green on that course that, you know, you can't putt off of at some point. But it's spectacular. And the way that the course is presented, it's immaculate, but not over the top. And the culture of it's a very family oriented club. And, you know, the club is for the members, but they're also welcoming to guests at the same time. I love it. I It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
Have you gotten to play the Dunes Club, the nine-holer up there?
Yes. Actually, I'm playing at the Dunes Club on Friday, kicking off my season there.
Thoughts? Fantastic again?
I'm a big fan of both the Dunes Club and Lost Dunes, in part because of their proximity to the city. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take that much longer to get to those places than it does to, you know, Olympia Fields when the traffic is bad, at least from where I am on the north side. So, yeah, the Dunes Club is just, I think that in terms of the spirit of the game, that's everything that, you know, golf should be. It's, there's a lot going on in terms of, you know, visuals at the course, and the holes are varied and cool and strategic and fun, and you can kind of make up your own adventure there. And because I've really become enamored with nine-hole golf courses, especially, you know, in my golf adventures, you know, there's something to be said about if a course is really good, being able to play it twice in the same day or even three times. You know, one of the things that makes me a little bit sad, it's kind of a silly thing to say, I know, but it makes me a little bit sad in some of my travels, is you go play a great course and in some instances, you know, you're never going to go back there again, just because of the logistics of it, or because there's so many other things on the list to get to. And, you know, one time around is never enough to get a full sense of what makes a golf course great. So the nine-hole courses that I've played, like Sweetens Cove or like the Dunes Club or Quagg Field Club or Whitensville in Massachusetts, where, you know, you can get around two or three times and really get more of a feel. You can play from different tees. You can play from different directions. You can try playing the hole one way one time and try playing it another way the next time around. I just think that that's a really great way to experience a golf course, and I love it. And on top of it, the fact that they have this incredibly small, low-key clubhouse where it's like, you know, there are two different things to eat, and everybody eats burgers because that's what's good. And there's a, you know, an honor bar and very minimal staff, and the staff that's there is like super friendly, and just laid back. Is it's wonderful. It's everything that I love about the game. It's like right in the bullseye for me.
And I also know you've done the Long Island trip. What was sort of the highlight of you playing out there, and what was some of your favorites from that one as well?
So I've been out to Long Island three times now. I've been to Boston twice and two or three times, and I've been to Long Island three times. You know, from a modern, in terms of the modern courses that we've played, Friar's Head is, you just can't beat that place. It's fantastic. I've played it a few times and gaining more and more of an appreciation for the front nine. You know, the back nine is what gets all the press because it has the, you know, the holes where you can see the water, and it's got, the topography is really incredible in the dunes. But the front nine is, the holes are just really well put together, and they've done some tree clearing out there, which has created some cross course vistas that are beautiful. So I'm a big Friar's Head fan. Like I said, this past year when we went to Quagg Field Club for the first time, and I really, really loved that place. It's just a super old school nine hole course that, Ian Andrew has been consulting at, helping them, put back together and kind of bring out all of its quirk and its charm. There's had the pleasure of interviewing the grounds committee chair there, Peter Imber, and he's an enlightened fellow, and he's done a lot to educate the membership, and that's a really special experience too. I really enjoyed that. And then of course, you know, going to Shinnecock is like going to church. That's a I just feel a great reverence for that place. It's magnificent. And what John Jennings does to present it on a daily basis is, I absolutely cannot wait to binge watch the U.S. Open this year, just to see the course and see, you know, the Corin Crenshaw updates that have been done out there and the way John presents the course. It's going to be a fantastic championship. And then, you know, I think probably the one that's risen the highest, obviously National Golf Links. That's a mecca for golf architecture nerds. I could play there every day for the rest of my life. And there's so much going on there. It's just really, really cool. A lot of creativity, a lot of creative expression, layered over the top of, you know, brilliant engineering and strategy by McDonald and Rayner. National is tops. But I think that, you know, the thing that impressed me the most on this most recent trip was seeing the renovated Maidstone, because we went out. I played Maidstone before they started the renovation the first time. So that was like 5-6 years ago. And since then, I haven't been back since then. And we went back this year and saw it all renovated and tuned up by their superintendent, whose name is John Genovese. And Corin Crenshaw have done some work out there. Dave Zinkend is doing some fine tuning out there. And Maidstone is just, I could play there every day for the rest of my life and be completely content. It is such a pleasurable experience. You know, multiple kind of ecological zones. You've got an area out in front of the clubhouse that is distinct. And then there's this kind of like wetland zone. And then you go out to the dune side and, you know, there are holes routed through the raw dunes out there that are just brilliant. And, in terms of variety and just fun and enjoyment, I just don't think that it gets any better than Maidstone.
Well, I've got two more here for you. One golf course and one final question. Prairie Dunes, where do you put that on your list?
Oh my gosh. you're just hitting all the high notes here, brother.
I haven't been there yet. Some guys I know took a trip there a couple years ago, and they said it's just fantastic. I got to definitely get down there to see that one, but I believe you've played it, so
I have. I've been out there for two long weekends. The last 2 years, I'm going out again this year, and I have a couple of friends who are national members there. As long as they're willing to include me in their annual trips, I will keep going until the day I die. It's one of those few courses that I have a very short list of courses that I wrote a post about this on Geeked on Golf called Musings on Greatness. And it was about, you know, it came to me coming off of the heels of my most recent weekend at Prairie Dunes, where, you know, when we go to Prairie Dunes, we play Prairie Dunes just from dawn until dark. And sometimes after dark, we just go around and around and around and around as many times as we possibly can. Played, I think 81 holes in one day, the first time that I went out there, and just basically play until we can't walk or swing the club anymore. And there are very few courses that meet this new standard that I'm calling 108 and 48ers. So in 2 days, like playing 108 holes on the same course in 2 days, I think a lot of courses are either too hard for that or not interesting enough for that. So for a course to be both extremely interesting and challenging enough without beating you up too much, Prairie Dunes meets that standard, and it's probably my favorite course from that perspective. I mean, the greens are it might have the best set of greens in America. The land is beautiful. There's a wonderful kind of texture and color contrast to it. And I think that the fact that, you know, Perry Maxwell did 9 of the holes, and then he passed away, and then his son, Press Maxwell, did the other 9 holes. And they're mixed together. It's not like, you know, 1-9 and then the other 9. They're all mixed together. Their styles were similar but distinct. And for that reason, I think that the course has a lot more character and variety to it, as opposed to if one guy or the other had done the entire thing. So, I mean, I've tried to play that golf course enough times to get bored with it, and it has not yet happened. I mean, if I could have walked more and maintained my sanity while living on V8 and beef jerky and Snickers bars, I would have played even more than the 81 holes that we played, but we just, it just couldn't physically do it anymore. And I can't say that.
The vibe of the club's kind of like pretty easygoing, right? Like it's not.
So they have a strong local membership of like it's a family club, but they also have this strong national membership of really kind of like educated golf connoisseurs, and they do a great job. The local folks are so welcoming and nice and generous with their course. I mean, you can tell who's who. It's easy to tell like who the interloping national members and their guests are. But everybody is just so friendly and the place is so welcoming, and they handle a lot of traffic very expertly. And the course is just in magnificent shape. I've been there in the summer and in the fall, and I'm hoping to get there in the spring one of these years so I can see it in all the seasons. But it's just a great, great place to be. And they've built some new lodging recently, which is really wonderful. And I just can't get enough of it. If I thought I could get away with it, like keep my marriage and join that place as a national member, I would have asked for an application by now.
It's that good, huh?
It's that good.
I got to get down there and see that one.
Absolutely.
I've heard nothing but great about it. And
it's magic.
When they had the NCAAs down there, just looking at it on TV, it looked fantastic. But
oh yeah, it's really, you know, with the cottonwoods and the gunch and the rolling land, it's got a really unique character to it. And the wind blows; you get all sorts of weather. It's just everything about it is just right on.
Well, my last question is: in your opinion, where do you think golf architecture will go in the next 10 to 20 years, and sort of what's your hope with it?
Well, I was just listening to an interview with Ian Andrew recently, who I think is one of the best thinkers that in the game in terms of architecture and history. I just really never get tired of reading what he writes and listening to him when he speaks. And he was talking about, I'm not sure that he said it exactly this way, but what I heard was him talking about, you know, kind of the ebb and flow of aesthetic trends within architecture. And he made a point which I tend to agree with, and which I think is showing itself on the community side perhaps more than, well, I guess you could see it on the resort side of things too, is, you know, there's been this movement towards big, which I think has been a good thing. I think wide fairways are as a rule better than narrow fairways. But you know, every trend has an upper limit. And I think that upper limit, we're seeing it with places like Stream Song Black and Mammoth Dunes. And so in part because there's just typically not land available in proximity to people to do that kind of thing much farther than it has been done. And in part just because I think that too much of a good thing starts to lose people's attention. So I'm very interested in what is going on in this. A part of this comes from being involved at Canal Shores, and part of it also comes from seeing places like the Sandbox or Bannon Preserve, or going to see a little, what is a private but community golf course like Quag Field Club, and now what they've done at the Cradle and Winter Park 9. I'm very interested to see how architects creatively use smaller space. I think that there's a kind of a land use responsibility component to that. I think that golf has to figure out how to stay relevant, but in a smaller footprint. And I just think that there's some really interesting opportunities in terms of, stretching the limits of how can you take a small space, maintain the strategic principles that we've recaptured here in the last 20 to 25 years in architecture, but not necessarily have to have a 80 or 100 yard wide playing corridor in order to do it. And I think that that's the kind of challenge of, you know, how do you keep the principles but put it in a smaller footprint? I think that that's the kind of challenge that actually stimulates some of these guys who are the best at, best working architects currently to kind of push themselves forward. I would love to, I can't wait to see what our ultimate architecture team does with Canal Shores. I can't wait to see, you know, some of the short course work that, like, I can't wait to see the short course at Ballyneal that the Renaissance team did. And I can't wait to see Winter Park. And I'm excited that guys of that caliber, you know, guys of Ian Andrews' caliber, of Dave Zinkin's caliber, of Corin Crenshaw and Doak and Gil Hance, that all of these guys are willing to take on these smaller footprint projects. To see, you know, like, how do you make it really interesting if the green's only 5,000 square feet instead of 15,000 square feet? You know, how do you make it really interesting if the corridor is only 30 yards wide? Not because you've planted trees along both sides, but because that's all the space you have to work with. How do you make it interesting if you have a limited maintenance budget, like they have at Winter Park or like they have at Rockwind? And I don't think that you necessarily have to settle just because it's small. I think it can be interesting and strategic at the same time. And there's plenty of opportunity for courses like that to be built or rebuilt. And I think we're going to see a boom of that in these coming years. And I'm super excited for that.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and your expertise. I truly love golf architecture and the discussion, and having you on was fantastic. So thank you so much, and I hope I can
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm never always have time for geeking out with kindred spirits, no doubt.
No worries. Thanks so much.
Thank you.